Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with David Ramsey, who is CIO at STG Logistics. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, Doug. Great to be here. Great. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Great. How about you?
Doing good. Happy start of the week here. And I don't know where you're at, but you know, we're just south of Cleveland and we've got snow coming more and more all day. So
So I'm in upstate New York, so I think we're probably not too far apart. Maybe 5 or 6 hours apart. But
yeah,
has it been like the winter without winter where you are too?
Yeah. I mean, we've been mid to high 60s in the last 10 days, and then yesterday, boom. Mm-hmm. You know, we're snow, sleet, everything else to remind us it's March. So
yeah,
all good.
Yeah. I'm a skier with my kids and stuff like that. And like, it's been okay. Cause the ski places have the ability to make snow, but overall it's been a pretty dismal ski season.
Yeah.
And like just no winter. I don't know. Do you participate in any sports like that or anything? Or?
Yeah, we ski. I mean, our little hill here in Cleveland was not even able to open this year. Right. So that's Boston Mills here in Cleveland, owned by Vail Ski Company, with 0 days of skiable.
Wow.
Time this year. So climate change, whatever else is going on, I don't know if I'd want to own mid-sized Midwestern ski resorts right now. So
I know. Yeah, I was seeing like news reports that further west, like you're in the Midwest too, but like the deep Midwest, if you will, like Minnesota and stuff like that, like they were having just no snow. All the ice stuff is not, you know, the ice fishing and all those things, like none of it happened across like most of the northern U.S.
It did not. Crazy. No, my daughter goes to the University of Minnesota. So she lives in Minneapolis, and warmest, I think it's the warmest winter on record in the last 50 plus years, that there's no ice on lakes, rivers, anything. So, I mean, that's even north of there. I wouldn't want to be in the snowmobile business as well, right? So
it's wild. Well, so anyways, we're on a leadership podcast. Maybe we should talk about IT leadership, huh?
Absolutely.
So you're currently the chief information officer at STG Logistics. Let's just start and say, can you tell us a little bit about what it is you do and what STG does to start?
Sure. I'll start with STG. STG Logistics, there's a history here. There's a legacy company called St. George Logistics and Trucking Company. So that's where the your S, the T, and the G come from. And we have two private equity backers. And we've done a number of acquisitions. And the largest one was we carved out about a $2 billion piece of XPO Logistics year and a half ago. And we've put this mousetrap together. We do lots of drayage, a lot of rail, trucking as well, but there's a method to the madness here. I was brought in by a few folks that I know at Oaktree Capital over the years to kind of help pull everything together. You know, that we've got some folks that you know, have grown up at a $300-400 million 3PL company, and we've got other people that were part of this monstrous business unit inside of XPO. So you've got people that have, you know, coming out of $16 billion publicly traded and $200-300 million privately held, and we're bringing these cultures together. I've been here since June, and really, you know, doing what I love to do, which is really building a leadership team, an IT leadership team that is capable of really bringing the company together and really refining that mousetrap and all of those go-to-market things that we all have with all of these combinations of, and there's about 14 acquisitions inside of STG. And then we have that big piece of XPO, and really trying to bring it all together and building out a leadership team and a product and technology roadmap for us for the next 3 years. So it's it's exactly what I like to do. I like to learn a new industry every 3 to 4 years. And I do mean learn a brand new industry every 3 to 4 years. And it's always the challenge of learning a new industry, learning a new business, bringing cultures together, and trying to, you know, right size the leadership team to be able to be able to really have an impact. So
Nice. So I'm gonna kind of zero right in on that, because I think that for the listeners of the podcast, one of the things that's really going to be interesting to hear from you, I mean, you're working in really, these are big companies, you know, this isn't, you know, 100 employees or 200 employees. I mean, you're talking about thousands of employees. You've got large IT staffs. You're integrating together a lot of different, different organizations, different entities. So I think what I want to ask you is, when you're integrating these teams together, what things are you looking for in the leaders that you're there? Because you're really leading leaders in an organization of this size in a lot of ways, I'm feeling. So what are you looking for in those people, and how do you bring them together? Mm-hmm. What do you do to get them to work together? And what things do you maybe even toss aside when you're like, nope, that's not going to work?
I think for me, having done this a few times in my career, meaning new guy, new ideas, but you've got to be able to pull along, some folks from all these different cultures inside of, you know, especially companies that are made up of 2, 3, 4 acquisitions, trying to find the right balance of a team where I've got fair representation from these different companies or business units, you know, and finding some talent there that is committed and very openly committed to building a single team that runs the enterprise. And sometimes it takes, you know, putting myself out on the plank, so to speak, and helping people along, or calming them down a bit and say, you know, we're going to do this together over the next 2 years. So I don't expect perfection, but along the way, when I can help, I'm going to help you. Right. And so we'll just get the people's nerves down a little bit, get them in a safe and comfortable spot, so to speak. Make sure we have representation from all the, for us, it's really a tale of two cultures coming together right now. Make sure the representation is there, but then also, some people that know me, I've got people, we've been traveling around together for the last 20 years together. So I've got a number of folks, and we call it, you know, basically David's traveling circus, right? Whether if we need an infrastructure person, we know where to go. A CISO, we know where to go, or, someone to help with strategy, governance, and things like that, we know where to go. So I try and balance leadership from those pieces of the culture with folks that I've worked with for 10 to 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And pulling them really together to say, you know, we need to build a shop that isn't just a siloed business unit by business unit by business unit, and we're repeating everything, you know, horizontally, meaning infrastructure, cloud, ERP, and everything else, that we need some people to take broader leadership across the enterprise. And that's what I'm smack dab in the middle of right now with STG. So.
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win, and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime, due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our 1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So we're still human, but we are some of the best, and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet@popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier, and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
You touched on something there. Now, and I've been in a similar situation where I've been asked to come into an IT organization that, you know, maybe it had a challenge, whatever the challenge may be, you know, whether or not it's well run or not, it's just, you know, there's a challenge. We're merging together this thing, we're growing, this thing's coming. Yeah. And a lot of times, like, I've had people that follow me from an organization, one organization to the next two. And I, you know, so I'm kind of excited that you mentioned that, because that is a strategy in a certain way where you're not reinventing the wheel of the people at the same time. You know, like, you bring in a known quantity and you've got folks that, you know, you can draw down on talent, and maintaining that network of other leaders that you know that you can reach out to and be like, hey, you know, hey, John, or hey, Jane, let's, you know, there's this new opportunity, but it's going to be a challenge. Yeah. It's really going to present with us this awesome, like just something just interesting. You know, you mentioned you like to move around and go from industry to industry.
I do think that balance, though, of balancing, you know, bringing people along for the ride. You know, anybody that I've been working with for the last 15, 20 years started new somewhere, right? So finding people who want to be along for the ride, to maybe they're someone who is a director of IT in a business unit, and we, you know, we have, hey, you know, really your skill set is more engineering. How would you like to run the app dev team across the enterprise, right? Well, geez, you know, I've never done that. Don't worry, we got your back. Let's figure out how to do that. And getting people to pull themselves out of that either acquisition mode or a legacy piece, or in our case, a very large chunk from a public company, and take on, you know, ownership across all of our different products and business units is really important. And to do that and to make an impact in that first year, you're probably going to need to infuse a little bit of energy from the past, right? In terms of I don't have time to recreate the wheel here when it comes time to, you know, how do I build a IT governance model, IT executive council, without over engineering it, but I need some folks that you know how to do that, and are, you know, closet financial people that can roll up budgets and know the difference between capitalization, expense, cloud, on-prem, you know, how do we shift models, things like that. So I try, probably not always successfully, but try and really balance making sure we've got, you know, we're lifting some people up that maybe it's probably not the happiest day of their life, you know, meeting a new boss, you know, so to speak. And how do we get over that quickly? But then how do we accelerate folks and you know, our impact on the company within that first year, right? Because you only get one chance to be the new person, right? Mm-hmm. You get 6 months in, you're starting to inherit, you know how this goes, especially in our line of work. It's not fair, but it is what it is. And I think anybody listening to this podcast is probably a reason why you listen to podcasts like this, because I personally believe CIO gigs, CTO gigs, I'll throw CISOs in there these days, right? These are some of the hardest jobs in the world, in my opinion. They're not, only because they're just not fair, are they, right? You have to put so much on your back and, you know, basically roll rocks up the hill for a living humbly, right? And there's no, maybe 30 years from now, this role will be easier to understand, or business folks will take more ownership on that digital, so to speak, end. But I've been at this for 25 years as a CIO. And there's, you know, it is the most unfair role within a corporate America. And once you accept that, and once you kind of let it sink in, then, you know, how do you humbly start pushing rocks up the hill, building roadmaps, building strategies, and really starting to underpin, you know, how the company runs? And could we, you know, everybody wants to hit a home run with technology. You know, how do we get to that point of large scale investments? And that requires a ton of trust. In our case, this is where it's challenging for us, right? It's private equity owned. We have a huge chunk of a former publicly traded company. We have a really profitable smaller piece from the past. But these cultures are massively different, right? And how do you build a team that can, and knowing full well it's a private equity world, right? You know, these guys want to hold these things for 3 to 4 years, add value, and, you know, potentially exit down the road. It does take a team that's kind of been there, done that before. And a lot of these thoughts or emotions or feelings have nothing to do with technology, do they? It's just, you know, how do you get these groups to start working as one, and then over time adding value? And that's really what I like to do. It's not easy, because it requires you to, man, be the new person every 3 to 4 years.
All the time, right?
All the time, right? And you know how much energy it takes to be the new person, right? Mm-hmm. One-on-ones, trips, get to know you, dinners, lunches, everything else, and nonstop, back to back. You know, Zooms or Teams calls in the middle of this hybrid world, and I wouldn't want to do anything else. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Now, so you know, I two comments and then another question here. First comment is, IT folks with finance knowledge and backgrounds or understanding of finance, underrated skill, 100%. Like you know, and you know, when you come to tech, like tech is not always, I like to tell folks, you know, particularly other leadership when they come in, they're like, oh, how can we solve this? And I'm like, tech may not be the solution to your problem. Like, my job is to know when tech is the solution to your problem, not to make tech the solution to every problem. And that's that, you know, that's a tough one to get across to a lot of leadership who are used to just being like, you know, please fix this problem right now and do something, you know, like, can you write a program for this? Can you do this thing or whatever the case may be? You know, it's really challenging when you're working at these breakneck paces. And so there's a lot I can just hear. Yeah. I could mentally envision this, like the weight, if you will, that comes down to solve the problem rapidly. And then a lot of people are like, David, solve it with tech, right? Problem solved, moving on, you know, we'll come back to them later. And you're like, whoa, 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 wait a minute.
No, I've learned, you know, over the years, it's not all just tech. It's funny you mentioned that about finance skills. Fortunately or unfortunately, I had the pleasure of working for a CFO for 8-9 years. Mm-hmm. So I was on the CFO staff, right? With the controller, head of planning, treasurer, the guy running Sarbanes-Oxley, this, that, and the other. And you know, whether I loved it or not, I guess I, and when I reflect on it, that's how I really became a pocket finance person, right? You know, how to capitalize things. What is depreciation? Why does a fixed asset and depreciation block you from moving to the cloud? Like, how do you get out of these cycles of, you know, capitalizing everything, but I want to move to the cloud, which is pure expense. I really think for younger IT leaders, even at a manager level, knowing how to run a P&L, read a P&L, understand your depreciation, how big is that fixed? How big is that asset, right? When people say, oh, just capitalize that work, right? At some point, you know, that hairball is growing larger and larger by the day. So I really feel like the ability to be an extremely competent financial person, kind of disguised as the nerd down in the nerdery, mm-hmm. some pretty good skills to have, meaning I don't know how you would fund anything cool without knowing how to kind of how to put that business case together, how to sell it, how to shop it, how to socialize it. How do you go from, I'm fortunate enough to work for our CEO. How do you go from a decent conversation there to selling it to CFOs, COOs, and then showing up at the next board meeting with the big lump in your throat. I don't care how old you get when mm-hmm. it's a $5, $10, $20 million project. It's everybody's staring at you and saying to themselves, like, oh, okay, here we go. You're taking a big risk here.
It's all on the line.
Yeah. And what I meant by maybe in 30 years, the management team and the boards will understand it's not just a single person that's putting those chips out onto the table, and it's not a gamble, it's the full company, right? And I think that's what probably keeps a lot of CIOs up at night, is the fact that you feel like you're the only one taking the risk. The company takes the rewards when they're there, and you know, punishes the response of, you know, that go live didn't go great, or something extended out, went over budget, things like that. But there's always someone like you and I willing to kind of push those chips on the table and say, I've been around long enough, I see what the problems are, and I'm willing to kind of take a deep breath and stand by that, the fact that we need to make these investments. And I have no problem doing that. It takes a lot out of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where those scars come from, is, you know, learning a business, understanding a business, taking a deep breath, taking a step back, but then kind of getting to the point of, these are probably the three bets that we probably should be making over the next 2 to 3 years. There is that moment as a CIO where you feel the weight of the world on your shoulders, and you feel like you're the only one, right? You know, as I always say, there's not many people or roles that are like this, where you feel like you're taking that gamble or risk with your own career, your life. Your kids may love the new town you live in, and you're already making the big gamble on your new technology project, and life doesn't go perfectly, right? And mm-hmm. But sometimes the biggest risk you take with your career is not taking one, right? So yeah. And then sometimes it's really hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going, it's, you know, for me, it's, you know, I guess personal story time, flip the tables here yeah. for a second. But, you know, so like I'm doing that in my current role, where I work for a nonprofit, a human services nonprofit in the Rochester, New York area.
Okay.
And one of the, where we grew a lot, you know, we were about 500 employees and about $40-50 million in revenue. And but we grew, doubled in size over the last, you know, 7 years or so. And as a consequence, like a lot of our systems were outdated. They were built for, you know, a smaller version of our company.
Yeah.
And so we are in the process of going through a comprehensive project to build out an enterprise architecture, model that architecture against what, you know, our needs, and, you know, solicit the feedback and everything else to push through doing yeah. new ERP and CRMs and, you know, workforce management and human capital management systems and stuff like that. It would be realistically like wholesale out the business's back end software operations. And like, that's it's a big deal to have to stand up in front of somebody and be like, you know, go to the CEO, go to the rest of the mm-hmm. board that's out there and say like, hey, guess what? We're going to go spend, you know, this is probably going to be a couple $1 million worth of investment over the course of,
yeah.
you know, 18, 24, 36 months. And, you know, that's, if it doesn't go well, there's only one person they're going to look at to say that it didn't go particularly well,
yeah.
you know, in spite of what might happen.
in spite of people believing that this role has changed over the years, I think it feels almost exactly the same. Meaning, You feel a massive sense of accountability that you are putting yourself, your career on the line to do something big. And I know full well, if you just sit there in the comfort zone for 2 to 3 years, you'll probably be labeled the CIO who just didn't know what to do, or they weren't visionary enough, right? You've heard it all before, and inevitably that cycle kind of collapses on top of yourself, right? So you have, I think that's what's addicting about the role, is that you know you have to push the rock up the hill while making progress at the same time. There's not many jobs like that, right? I mean, I have a lot of good friends that are CFOs, but you know what? That rarely are they asked every 2.5 years to put your neck out on the chopping block and to move forward, right? You gotta
let's reinvent the place. Yeah.
You got a monthly close, you got a quarterly close. If you're private, might be a little bit easier than being public. If you're public, then you're a little more outward facing. And I get it. It's a tough role, but these CIO things are just so unscripted, meaning if you sit there in the chair for 3 years and don't do anything, except, you know, maybe make the help desk run a little bit better, you'll probably be known as that guy that now they're looking for the innovative guy, right? So I would say I tend to be more towards a builder than a maintainer. Mm-hmm. So taking those risks a little bit, I've been doing that my whole career. But as I get older, I do ask myself, is that really fair, right? Have we not infused this technology everywhere in our lives where everybody can say, hey, we really would like to do more here, and I'm not boxed into a percent of revenue or a IT cost per end user mm-hmm. type of discussion that we were having maybe 15 years ago. So,
So I'm gonna change this direct into a different area of discussion here. But you mentioned about the culture and bringing people together, and so can you maybe share with our listeners a little bit about what elements of culture do you want to build in the organizations that you build? You're doing this every 2, 3, 4 years at this point. Yeah. So each time you're having to figure out what kind of culture you want. So you probably have a lot of experience and insight to share. So I'd love to hear more about that.
You are right. And if I think about it, I do start to laugh. Like I have an embed, almost like firmware. I have a playbook in my head. Mm-hmm. I know really what I want to get after in those first 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. The biggest thing for me is if you find that you've kind of wandered into a brand new shop and the problems aren't easily, you can't really learn. It's impossible to learn a company, meaning it's not open. There's not a Teams channel or Slack channels with, tickets coming in, and I can start to read tickets in real time and see where the issues are. If everything's cordoned off and hidden, I spend a lot of my time just turning black boxes clear, mm-hmm. Whether they're issues or not. We need to be very upfront about, our service metrics. Where are the problems at? And when you said door culture, how do you build that cultural world where you feel like you're in a safe place to, run out in traffic on a Saturday, meaning in a public Slack channel, and say, hey, this is blowing up on me and I need help right now. From probably your career, at engineering teams that feel safe, like they're in a safe place to do that. Mm-hmm. Time to resolving issues or fixing things is just second nature.
They are more productive because they will collaborate to solve the problem as opposed to trying to hide it.
This is where you see some of that, IT abuse creeping in, meaning, man, I tried to be open one time and, the VP of fill in the blank just crushed me for being too open and too honest and this, that, and the other. So how do you create a culture where the problems really surface themselves, and we reward that behavior more than we do hiding the problem. Meaning, you know, it ain't, you've heard this 100 times, or at least this is one of mine, where it ain't broke till it's fixed, right? Meaning no one really knew what the issue was until someone issues that hero, that walk-off home run hero email that says, hey, I just fixed this problem. Well, number one, I didn't even know it was a problem. Number two, you know, that's a lot of users there that were impacted. We probably could have done a better job communicating. So for me, it's the first stop on that culture train is just developing a culture of being transparent and being comfortable enough to step out there and just say, hey, I got a problem, and how do you help, right? And now that we're all in this hybrid world, what are the tools? What's the tooling that's needed in order for a shop to function like that? So first stop for me is just that transparency. Sometimes it's a tooling issue as well, right? Just, you know, you got 9 different help desk platforms, 9 different leaders trying to do things, different things. You know, how do we consolidate so that visibility goes up and the trust goes up, right? So, and you'll see with your business, you know, users, owners, however you want to describe that, when they see someone being that open and transparent, it tends to rub off, and we're coming together, we're not button heads, and we're really solving problems. And a lot of times, I think with having done this, yeah, 5, 6 times, that playbook of just creating openness and transparency, it works on the business side too, because a lot of times from the business side is, you know, you get that age old thing, like, I just have no idea what you guys are even talking about. There's just, it's a lot of acronyms. It's a lot of gobbledygook. And I need a translator, but I need someone who's willing to help create a culture that it is open, and it's okay to raise your hand and say, I got a major problem here, and I need some, you know, whether it's talent, more resourcing, or, you know, some investment in some new technology. It all starts with being transparent with where your issues are. And if you're not, you know, good luck to you and your funding, right?
Yeah. I'm personally a big fan of, I refer to it as radical transparency. I'm sure I did not invent that word. So, yeah. but the, you know, the idea that is the leader, I am always comfortable answering a question about like what's going on, you know. So like there should never be a point in time when like somebody comes to us and they say like, hey, what's happened here, or even the team as well. Yeah. You know, like you should be open about what is happening at any given point in time, you know, within confidentiality reasons, of course, but to, you know, like I shouldn't have to conceal the activities of the department from somebody else in order to more effectively get our work done. Yeah. And that really creates by as long as you are open and sharing, you really build, that's one of the key ways to build bridges with those different departments, you know, that you're working with. I mean, because like you're a service organization at the end of the day. When you're in IT, you're servicing the rest of the business. I guess unless your product is the software and you're the software development person, but for the most of us, we're in service to something else.
Absolutely. I think that's well said.
Yeah. So, we talk a little bit, we talked about what you're doing now, what, you know, the cultures that you've liked to see and build, but we'd love to know a little bit more about like you know, your history. So how did you, you know, can you walk us through kind of your professional history a little bit to understand how we got to now?
Sure. I think it goes back a ways. I think there was really one person in my life who took a great gamble with his own career and made a 28-year-old kid a CIO. And that was at a post IPO of a company down in Jacksonville, Florida called PSS World Medical. Later we sold to McKesson. But I was working for the CFO at the time, Dave Smith. This is a CFO we were just discussing. Teach you all about, you know, he's a former like PwC partner, right? So very finance heavy, but
But a great mentor.
Very loudest voice in the room. Great mentor. Things like that. And I was my first role there was we were rolling out Oracle financials back in the Oracle 10.6 days for those paying attention here, which is really old. We're doing financials, AP, some different things, helping the company go public at the time was about 160 million. Something happened over in IT. I really wasn't paying attention. And I ended up as the interim CIO there. Which I never really aspired to do. But I spent almost 10 years there growing that business. So we grew that place from about 160 million to over 3 billion in that course of 10 years with about 125 acquisitions. All of us, I mean, they said, we used to laugh. We used to have people tell us that your compensation is experience. I mean, you know what I mean? At my age now, I'd be like, yeah, okay, that's funny. Let's have another conversation. But I think back to those days, and those are some of still my best memories, kind of growing up in the business world. And I probably have spent the last 15 years chasing, looking for another culture like that, because it was addicting. We were doing so many acquisitions, even back then in the early 2000s, right? The technology platform really, really mattered, meaning there wasn't anybody sitting back and saying, this is a waste of money, even back then, right? We put warehouse management systems in, ERP systems in, 50, 60 warehouses at a clip, you know, 2,000 sales reps. We were doing, even at the end there, almost 70% of that revenue in the early 2000s, e-commerce revenue, which if you remember that fun e-com bubble, that's kind of all that mattered. I did that for almost 10 years. And I really wanted to find some experiences around manufacturing and international work as well. So my first run-in with an actual executive recruiter, I guess I'd been sitting in a chair long enough where someone would call you. Sometimes that's really exciting. Like you want to talk to me about what? Like, oh my gosh.
Like, hooray. Okay. Like you want to speak.
You know how that goes. Today. And then one thing leads to another and you get a first interview and they're like, well, that went really well. You want to keep doing this? And you know, one thing leads to another, you get a new role. We moved from Jacksonville, Florida to Texas to San Antonio for a crazy med device company at the time called KCI. Mm-hmm. That thing went from about 200 million to 2 billion in less than 3 years. The growth was crazy. And that eventually kind of, you know, I learned a lot. It's publicly traded again as a CIO, all that fun. Sarbanes-Oxley, good times there. But I got a lot of international experience, which I had never had before. We were a US-based company at PSS. So that was really fun for me. Trips to Amsterdam, India, all that kind of stuff. So all of that international stuff started to open up for me. Great experiences there. And along the way, like we all do, we meet different people from different companies, and we found ourselves up here just south of Cleveland at Diebold. I don't know if you've ever pulled money out of a cash machine.
I know Diebold well. I'm a audit committee chairman for a large credit union. So, you know, and have done many years when I was at IT consulting. I was playing with the ATMs on the backside.
So, yeah, and that we can have another discussion one day about the company culture of a, you know, 155-year-old company, right? Basically a safe manufacturer that was crazy enough to stick a laptop inside of it and put cash inside of it and push it out onto a street corner. We did a lot there, a lot of ERP work, and again, just 82 countries. Probably some of the toughest stuff that I've ever done personally in my career was, you know, the 80 plus countries. It starts to get wildly complex. regional differences, things like that. So I did that for right around 4 years. And then, you know, from there on, I've been remote since 2014, really. Kind of doing these types, you know, 2 to 3 year runs as CIOs, whether they're interim or others. I've been in the BPO space with TTEC out in Denver for a little over 2 years for that project. And then I went back in to private equity with a background screening platform. So I kind of learned my engineering chops all over again. And then an old friend called, and over the last 2.5 years before STG, we were at a startup called Butterfly Network, which creates it's the world's smallest handheld ultrasound on a chip. You know, your big medical facility there in Rochester was our largest preeminent first client. So you may see a Butterfly device if you're unfortunately have to check into your local big clinic that you have there in town. We did that for two and a half years. I'm going to say we again. We've got a little bit of a traveling circus of friends, and probably I've got two people that we've done the last three to four things together. So and then now we're at STG, and that opportunity really came through some connections from the private equity side. I've got someone that used to work for me way back in our PSS days, Ish Sundaram. Ish was the CIO at JetBlue for many, many years. And now he does a lot of advisory work with Oaktree Capital. And we talk maybe once a month. We have for the last 20 years. And, you know, the opportunity to come kind of help this newly formed thing together was an offer I couldn't refuse. So that kind of catches you up to current. So
awesome.
A lot of different experiences, a lot of different industries, things like that. I mean, I always get, it's kind of funny, we're doing a podcast like that. This is the running joke with most of my teams is, when are you going to retire? Because I just want to sit back and listen to the podcast of all the stories. Right. So
we've got like 260 episodes.
This is a good start.
That's right. You can just add it right to the catalog.
At Dissecting Popular IT Nerds, we expect to win, and we expect our IT directors to win. And one of those areas where we know that we can help you win is internet service providers. As an IT director tasked with managing internet connectivity, few vendor relationships can prove more painfully frustrating than the one with your internet service provider. The array of challenges seems never ending, from unreliable uptime and insufficient bandwidth to poor customer service and hidden fees. It's like getting stuck in rush hour traffic. Dealing with ISPs can try one's patience even on the best of days. So whether you are managing one location or 100 locations, our back office support team and vendor partners are the best in the industry. And the best part about this is none of this will ever cost you a dime due to the partnership and the sponsors that we have behind the scenes at Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. Let us show you how we can manage away the mediocrity and hit it out of the park. We start by mapping all of the available fiber routes, and we use our $1.2 billion in combined customer buying power and massive economy of scale to map all of your locations, to overcome construction fees, to use industry historical data, to encourage providers to compete for the lowest possible pricing, to negotiate the lowest rates guaranteed, and to provide fast response times in hours, not days. And we leverage aggregators and wholesale relationships to ensure you get the best possible pricing available in the marketplace. And on top of all of this, you get proactive network monitoring and proactive alerts so that you're not left calling 1-800-GO-POUND-SAND to enter in a ticket number and wonder, why is my internet connection down? In short, we are the partner that you have always wanted, who understands your needs, your frustrations, and knows what you need without you having to ask. So we're still human, but we are some of the best, and we aim to win. This all starts with a value discovery call where we find out what you have, why you have it, and what's on your roadmap. All you need to do is email internet at popularit.net and say, I want help managing all of my internet garbage. Please make my life easier, and we'll get right on it for you. Have a wonderful day.
So now, we do ask, one of the things we always love to ask is like really going back in history. So when what got you into technology, and or what was your first like technology or computer experience? Like what were you, an IBM PC person, the Commodore 64? Were you, you know, TI? I was a TI 99-4A guy, but you know.
Did you get that? So we had a TI. My father was an engineer, so willing to step out there and buy, you know, brand new IBM PCs back, you know, in the days where they were, you know, XT. I forget those things, but yeah, no, I probably had a PC available to me, fortunately, since I was, you know, fifth grade. And for someone my age, for people listening in, it was a very big deal back in the day to have one sitting in your basement. But yeah, that was so, but the technology to me was always been something, lots of pieces of technology. You don't have to pay me to continue to do research on what's coming next, what's really out there. Even in my advanced age, I find myself lapping the 20-somethings on what's really happening in the tech world. It hasn't been something I've had to force myself to learn. I've had to learn the finance stuff, the leadership stuff, but the technology, the love of technology has really always been there for a very long time. Still to this day, I can't even disclose what my gadget budget is in this household, right? So
I was, you know, similar background. Like I was, as a kid, it was just sort of assumed that I would be in the computer business. You know, like it was like, oh, Doug knows computer things and he'll do computer stuff and he'll be all set because he'll be in the tech business. And like that solves one problem of what the kids are going to do with his family.
It does. I mean, even it's kind of like being the AV kid back in, you know, fourth, fifth and sixth grade, you know, it continues on to this day. Like even if we just had a board meeting, back in January, and someone just says, you know, there's going to be four or five board members that aren't going to be able to attend. Can we just set up a mobile, you know, Zoom room at the hotel? This is completely offsite. So there I am, show up at this board meeting. I got two backpacks full of gear. Like I got a little owl thing, you know, for the 360 camera. I got a 4K projector, separate laptop to run the Zoom room. Got a little Mac, you know, a little iPad screen to run the mobile Zoom room, and boom, you know, I'm down there at 6:30 a.m. Cobbling this thing together and loving every minute of it still. And everybody walks in and boonk, and just, you know, again.
You got the Mary Poppins bag. That's what I refer to that internally as, the Mary Poppins bag.
That satisfaction of just like, oh yeah, look at this, you know, and it's on hotel Wi-Fi. Can you believe that? Right. So yeah, I don't have to wander far from the love of technology. So at all.
Wow. Well, so we're coming to the end here of our interview, but before we go, the one thing I always make sure to ask is there's really two questions, I guess. One is, you've been in this a long time, so what lessons did you learn now that you wish you would learn then? And also, what would you want to share with listeners about like being a leader in the IT space, that like if you were giving advice to somebody?
Oh man, I think the biggest thing that I've learned along the way in terms of IT projects, getting to the other side, ripping the Band-Aid off, so to speak. I know this is hard advice to take on, but you know, the smoothest way across a gravel road is 90 miles an hour, right? So this is my grandfather used to say this, like literally the fastest way across a bumpy road is 90 miles an hour. And he's wasn't wrong, meaning you are always going to have problems. You're going to have 10 problems every morning. Doesn't matter what you're doing. It's just how can you absorb those? Did you plan well enough? But once you get moving, you better go fast, right? Mm-hmm. And this incessant desire with IT people to chunk things up into yet another phase, and I'm going from pilot to phase to this and that adds up, right? And your time as a CIO is over after those first 24, 36 months. And if you haven't really moved the needle too far, they're going to probably look for someone who can do it, right? Now, granted, our profession is much like being a, my wife calls this, like you're essentially like an offensive coordinator for an NFL team, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it comes down to how good of a quarterback you have, what kind of this. It's not just all the magic that you personally bring, but I guess the biggest piece of advice I have is when you see the business need and you know exactly how you can solve it, and if you know how to get through, how to sell it, how to fund it, how to capitalize it, how to push it to the cloud, how to do that, when you get that green light, you got to buckle in and go, and you have to have thick enough skin to keep going until it's done, right? And because everybody's rooting for, a lot of people are rooting for you to kind of slow down,
mm-hmm.
take a break, don't worry. Oh, you want another phase? Oh, you want to delay your go live by 6 weeks? That's smart, right? You know, I think that's the smart thing to do. I've learned that, like, not to do things, you know, reckless, but once you get that momentum, you will never get that back at that company, right? And you had better go, and you'd better have enough resolve and enough gas in the tank to make it through, right? So, and this comes back to that. This is where I think the role is sometimes unfair, where people are asking you to gamble with your life, right? So to speak, for an ERP project or a big replatforming of your cloud product, right? It's all on you, right? And trust me, I've moved 3 kids all over this country with all of these moves that we were talking about. And, you know, sometimes those moves aren't the happiest times when you talk to your kids, but when you talk to them now, though, they're very happy. They have all these crazy experiences. But I can think back and say, you know, 2 times where we went and did something new was because programs or projects kind of fizzled out and they just kind of ended, right? Because we lost sight of having enough mental fortitude to just finish, right? And if you have that opportunity to get that momentum, the funding, the board support, leadership team support, they want to see you have, you know, that leadership kind of backbone to be able to finish that thing off, because it's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be easy. And do you want to be known as a CIO who actually is the one that got them off the mainframe or moved them from SAP to the cloud? If you want to be that person and have that big of an impact on a company, you got to go as fast as you can. So, and that's it's not fun. It's counterintuitive to life.
Mm. That's amazing. I'm really glad you like unspooled that. And it was a great narrative to share. So yes. David, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
Yeah.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.